Church, this is Mike Stubbs. Does he look familiar to you? Yes? Mike, you deaconed for a long time here. You and your family joined the church a while ago. Let's see, it's Alex, Joe, and Danny, and Susie is your wife.
Right.
And have you ever spoken in front before?
No, not at this church.
Not at this
church. But in other ones, but briefly, not like this.
Not like this. How you feeling?
A little bit woozy, but okay.
Here, my friend.
Thank you.
We're going to hear from Mike in a moment. Please remember that during the summertime, we share the sermon with storytellers. So the sermon in the summer will always be one part sacred story from the Word and one part sacred story from a storyteller's life. So that's what happens this morning. Now, when I was talking with Mike earlier this week about his story, he said to me, "Chris, you don't have to worry that I'm going to get up there and go on and on and on. Because my father taught me a few things." Here's what Mike said to me. My father taught me, quote, "Everyone needs to listen to someone, even if you are the president. Don't get all political." This was a few decades ago. All right. "Everyone needs to listen to someone. You never learn anything with your mouth open," Mike's dad taught him. And finally, his dad said, the fool is thought to be wise, even if he what? Keeps his mouth shut. So you don't have to worry, Chris, I'm not going to get up there and go on and on and on. It's not in my character. What Mike did this week was speak to me in short, pithy, wise sayings. That grassroots wisdom, the everybody knows kind of wisdom, the thing we say and everyone starts to nod their head, and all cultures have them. When I was in front of the coffee shop a few years ago, I'm walking by a group of older guys drinking their coffee. "What'd you have for lunch?" "I had a hot dog from the 99-cent store." Other guy says, "You don't eat hot dogs from the 99-cent store. They got gophers and guts in them." Like everybody knows. What are you doing eating a 99-cent hot dog? When we open the Bible, we call that proverbial wisdom, Proverbs. The Proverbs is the book in the middle of the Bible, and there are some assumptions about Proverbs in the middle of our Bible. The assumption is that they come to people who are already deciding to live in a covenant relationship with God. So the Proverbs are not for evangelizing and for spreading everywhere else. They're for what we could call insiders today, the Proverbs. We'll make it a little easier if I say a couple things about the book of Proverbs. Number one is there's no storyline. There's no Adam and Eve. There are no great epics with Abraham and Sarah. There's not a Daniel in the lion's den. There's no story in Proverbs. But all those stories are known and assumed behind this wisdom material. First. Second, there's no organization. So where are you, type A people? Your sock drawers are organized. Where are you? In your garages, in your cars, and all the things. Proverbs will drive you crazy. It's not organized. It's a cluster of sayings, and riddles and poems will sit right alongside instructions. Don't try to figure Proverbs out. Third, there's only two ways of living in the book of Proverbs. There is the wise way and the foolish way. There is the righteous way in the book of Proverbs, and then there is the wicked way. This way is what they call wisdom, and this way is what they call folly. And it's easy for us to say right and wrong, but I'm not sure that quite does justice. It's more complex than that. There are two ways to go in this life. There is a wise way. And if you look down this road, it seems to be common sense in a life with God, a life of well-being and wholeness and goodness. When we say be well around here all the time, this is the life we're talking about. It seems if you make these decisions, then life goes well. And it seems like if you make the foolish decisions, decisions full of folly, then things go less well. The book of Proverbs, it's not written by any one author. It's a cluster from all generations, not any one time in Israel's history, but over generations and maybe centuries of time. It's what wise people notice when they look around the world and observe. We can see some things. There's only really one criteria to make it into the book of Proverbs in the Bible. Does it ring true? Does it seem to make sense? Then it's in the book. But we ought not be fooled that it's that simple, because they also contradict each other. In one book, in Proverbs chapter 26, you'll find a verse that says, "Don't answer a fool, it's a waste of time." But the very next verse will say, "Answer a fool, don't let them off the hook." So it's a little more complicated than it might seem just reading them straight out of Scripture. I think the best way to understand, to hear, to read a proverb is to imagine that a wise person, a mentor, a teacher is strolling with us through the world. Look, see that leader over there? There's a lesson to be observed. Look, see that employee over there? There's a lesson to be observed. Look at that family over there. There's a lesson to be observed. Look at that husband and wife. Look at that teenager. Oh my word, there's a lesson to be learned. Look at that servant, slave. There's a lesson to be learned. I think it's the best way to hear the Proverbs when you open the book. From the royal court to the bank to the farmlands, if our eyes are open, living life with God, there are lessons to be learned. So here's a proverb that came to mind, Mike, as I read through your story earlier, last week and this week. Here's a proverb from your story that came to my mind. Maybe it will come to you as you listen to Mike share. From Proverbs 22, can you read together? "Train up a child in the way he should go. When he is old, he will not depart from it." Train up a child. We don't even have to finish the rest of the proverb. The adults in the room all start nodding their heads. You can be standing in clusters of grandparents and aunties and uncles and parents, and they're sharing woes about their children, younger or older, and sometimes someone will say, "Train up a child," and everyone nods their head. We seem to know what it means, train up a child, and when they're older. That also means if the child goes the wrong way, well, then it must not have been trained up right. Amen? Well, or it could also mean, hey, wait a minute, I know I trained that child up right. It's not me, it's the child. There's something inherently wrong with the child. Train up a child. We wash our hands and walk away. Train up a child in Christian circles can then become shorthand, friends. Shorthand for when we want to diagnose disaster or we want to praise children. Performance. This is not how Proverbs work. A proverb is not a promise that our children will be saved. Our promise is not a formula, do A and then we will get B. A proverb is not a tool or a weapon to get conformity out of the younger generation or to induce guilt in the older generation. The proverb is an ancient way of teaching when you can't Google the answer or buy the book on Amazon. This is simply what a proverb is. A simple observation from living. God has a way for our children. God has a way for life to be a little more complete and a little more full and a little more peace and a little more wholeness. So Eugene Peterson translates our proverb this way: point your kids in the right direction. When they're old, they won't be lost. Now that feels a little different, doesn't it? When they're old, they'll have a sense of direction. When they're older, they'll have some perspective. When they're older, they might have their bearings on how to hear the voice of God. Listen now for a word from Mike's life.
Hi, my name is Mike, and I'm here to tell you about my journey with substance abuse. More importantly, the biggest thing that I want to, and most important thing I want to get across to you is what Jesus did for me and what I couldn't do for myself, where he took me from. So I'll start with my family. I was born and raised in Glendale, California in the 1970s. I'm one of 10 children. My parents were functioning alcoholics, really good people though. My dad was a brilliant man. He was a lobbyist for a state assemblyman, and after that ended, he ended up at the RTD, the Rapid Transit District in Los Angeles, doing the same thing. He parlayed that into an executive position, and so he was gone a lot, traveling either to Sacramento or Washington. My mom was a stay-at-home mom, large family. Parents liked to be on the cocktail circuit. They liked to have cocktail parties. They'd let my siblings drink at 18, as long as it was in the house and they weren't driving. Naturally, as a kid, you want to grow up to be like your parents. You have nothing but love and admiration for your elders. And I still love them to this day. My parents were remarkable people. Same with my siblings. At 10 years old, I started smoking cigarettes. The next year, at 11, I started drinking. My first drink was vodka and Dr. Pepper, which it doesn't work, but I started drinking beers after that. By the time I was 12 years old, I was hooked on cigarettes. They're really easy to get hooked on. First thing in the morning, I'd be smoking as soon as I woke up. My younger brother started at 8. He started with me. And we'd walk to school smoking. Now, we're walking to a Catholic school smoking. So we were known as the two boys who would smoke on the way to school. We didn't care. By the time I was 14, which this is the first picture, that's the age I started smoking marijuana. Look how young I was. 14 years old, just a baby. And I actually really liked it. So that was at my graduation party for eighth grade with my two best friends in school. By high school, I had been doing much harder drugs. I started with acid, LSD, mushrooms, uppers, downers, Quaaludes, Valium, along with the drinking and smoking pot. I'd try just about anything except heroin. I don't like needles, and I felt like heroin, with the way I was, I would be hooked and I would die quickly. But the problems really got more complex as I got into high school. I started stealing. I'd break into houses with my friends. Mostly it was just a drink and maybe try to look for money, anything we could steal to support our habit. But also breaking into cars, I was getting into fights. My parents were sued in 1978 from a kid who I punched. They sued my parents for $4,000. I was in a really bad place. My father had pretty much had enough of me by the time I was 15, and I don't blame him. It was the best thing he ever did for me. He started telling me, look, you are gonna be out at the park with the bums for all I care. You're not taking your little brothers down with you. And I agree with him. I was a bad influence to my little brothers. I was a bad influence in my community. I did horrible things. The worst part came when I was in 10th grade. I ended up in jail for a minuscule amount of marijuana. The police busted me at the park, but that's because the mothers in the neighborhood were hysterical and they were over-exaggerating things to the Glendale police, so they threw me in jail. But make a long story short, when my dad picked me up, I'll never forget the look on his face when he saw me in that jail. I think he just must have hit rock bottom. I'll never forget that. But what's even worse is I didn't even care. I just wanted to get out of there and be with my friends and get high again. By the 11th grade, my dad put in my mind, you ought to think about going into the military. It might do you some good and give you some direction. Your grades aren't that good. You're only doing well in history and maybe art and music, but that was it. So I thought about it and I thought, sure, I can get out of here, I can make money, and I can travel. So my next picture is when I went in the Navy, but my problems only got worse. The drugs were easier to get overseas. I was hanging around the same type of people. I'd go in and out of port, and one of my friends in the Philippines, this girl I knew, she would go to the pharmacy for me and buy me narcotics. But after a while, she said, I'm not going and I'm not doing that for you. I think she thought I was gonna either overdose or she'd just say, you're loco. One of the two. Shortly after that, I got busted on a couple urine tests. The Navy sent me to a drug rehab, and they flew me off my ship in the Indian Ocean all the way to Miramar Naval Air Station. And our counselors told us that this six-week program was $10,000 per patient, which in 1983 was a lot of money. And it worked for about 2 months. They recommended me back to the command, but I started hanging around my old friends. And that's the hardest thing, to give up your friends and your way of life to a drug addict or alcoholic such as myself. Well, I continued and I barely got out of the Navy. I got an honorable discharge. I got out, I was pretty scared. I had nowhere to go. I had saved up a lot of money, but I knew I couldn't go live with my parents anymore. They were having none of this, nothing, and I don't blame them. It's the best thing my father ever did for me. So my mom gave me a Rhymes Douay Bible because I started going back to the Catholic Church and I'd read it, and I was spiritually minded, but I had a problem that everybody else seemed to know I had a problem, but me recognizing that I had a problem, you don't want to hear it. No, I don't have a problem. You guys are the one who have a problem. But down this spiral path I went. I was fast hitting the bottom, and as a civilian, I soon met my wife, who was my girlfriend. She introduced me to a 5-day stop smoking program, which actually it worked. But the drugs and alcohol were a whole nother ball of wax. We got married, which is my next slide. I don't know. That's us. And we had a kid, and my wife was thinking I was gonna suicide. That's the type of deep hole that I was in. And she went away for a weekend because she had had it up to here, just like everybody else did with me. That was in May of 1989. I had gotten off my job. I was alone that weekend, Memorial Day weekend. And I had gotten off my shift at the supermarket at 11:30 at night. I went over to my two friends with my little brother, who was sober at the time. He doesn't do drugs, he just drank a little bit. We went over. I started smoking weed and drinking a beer. And there was a song by Led Zeppelin that came up. And the song was, "Baby, Baby, I'm Leaving You." And Jesus was using that song to speak to the deepest part of my soul. I know what you're thinking, but I hadn't had enough to be stoned or drunk. I was sober. Two hits of pot and a half of a beer isn't going to do it. It wasn't going to do it for me. And I believe that instead of being filled with liquor and alcohol at the time, I was consumed by the Spirit. And I got very scared. I felt like He was turning away from me, and if this was my last chance, kind of like the last call at a bar for alcohol. This is the last stop, pal. We're almost done here. And I got scared. I felt like I was going to die. I closed my eyes, and then I felt a very peaceful, serene come over me, and I felt Christ telling me that if I did in fact decide to quit, that He would be with me and He was going to help me, and I was not going to have this problem again. I tell you, it's really hard to quit, but He made it easy. My eyes were closed. I opened my eyes, and one of my friends across the way started humming a song. And then it got louder, and he started singing the song, and it was the John Denver song. He thought it was the drugs. He started singing, "Colorado, Rocky Mountain High," and he was mocking me. But I didn't care. I went from Led Zeppelin to John Denver in a matter of moments. So anyway, I decided that night to quit, and I've been sober for 29 years. But I want to tell you, it's been really easy, because when I had to go to the meetings in the Navy, the AA meeting, in the NA meeting, Narcotics Anonymous, there were people who had to go three times a day just to stay sober. That was shocking to me. The trauma that I learned that kids go through at 7 years old, they were raped, they were molested, there were people dying in front of kids, parents that were dying in front of them, or just traumatic things. I was a sheltered existence, but when I stopped, my family members or friends that were still users would offer me things, but I never had any kind of temptation to go back to that life. I've never wanted to. I still love them to this day. But let me tell you what's happened to some of my friends. The first guy I ever got high with in eighth grade ended up dying at 18 years old. My best friend on a motorcycle. Just a wild, reckless way to live. My brother-in-law committed suicide. My two best friends, my two best partying friends in the Navy, both died late 40s. God has spared me from these things, and I'm very grateful. I'm also grateful that I've been able to bring up my three beautiful daughters. My dad would have been stunned to see what my kids turned out like, because they went to college, but That's not what really impresses me. What impresses me that they're trustworthy, something I wasn't, and something that Jesus did for me, much older than they were. One of the other things I'm grateful for is my dad was able to see that I sobered up. For the last 4 years of his life, he saw me sober. And I'm really grateful because I don't think he ever thought that was going to happen. The prophecies about alcohol that are written about in the Bible are true. Those prophecies are so true today. They've never been truer. With all the drug abuse, alcohol abuse, it's a deception and a lie. And it does bite like a serpent. I know that for a fact. I've lived it. And my parents, I love them, and I would never speak here if they were alive. But it made them bitter at the end of their life. And I'd tell my children, look at the difference between this community, our church, the people who have a normal, sober life, and you look at my parents, and it's no disrespect. My children loved my parents, but I'm grateful for the example that you guys have always done for your children, grandchildren, and the community. There's only one thing in closing I want you to think about. It's something I often think about. Jesus died on the cross for us. We all know that. But he was offered drugs to deaden his pain. He refused it because he wanted us to have a future. He wanted to be engaged with us in our school, in our community, with our family, our children, our grandchildren, and at our work. And not only that, in our future. And now is the time, if ever there was a time to be sober when everything's being legalized, to stand together and be sober. Thank you.
Mike, thank you for your honesty today, for opening up your life. It is true that to look at a life is a sacred task, the sacred listening to Mike's story. It's true that we wander and that we find ourselves in dark spaces and we get lost for a while. The Christian life is not a tidy life. Isn't it true, friends, especially those who've lived a while, you can be wise in some areas of your life, all the while being foolish in other areas. It can happen all in the same day, the same week. And maybe it wasn't the partying life in your family or the partying life right now. Maybe it's judgmentalism and gossip and rumor and rancor that was modeled for you. Maybe it was elitism or exclusivism. Maybe it came from church. Maybe you saw people who didn't know how to share resources or have compassion in the world or have their eyes open to what God would. We could have seen all sorts of foolish. You could fill in the blank. For Mike's family, it was the partying life. Sometimes we get in dark spaces. But Mike, your story isn't finished. It's not even finished today as you stand here and tell us 29 years sober. So I want to read one more proverb for you and for all of us, a proverb to close our worship service today from Proverbs chapter 20 and verse 7. The righteous live with integrity. Happy are their children who come after them. The righteous, meaning the content, the truthful, the honest, those with their faces turned towards God. They live with integrity, and happy are their children who come after them. I've heard you say in the last couple of weeks that you feel a lot of regret and remorse, Mike, for things that happened when you were younger, and shame for choices you made when you were younger. But hear a word from the Proverbs. The righteous live with integrity. Happy are their children who come after them. Hear a word from your daughters. When I ask Alex and Joe and Danny, tell me about your dad, this is what the girls say. Our dad's challenges have helped him keep an open dialogue while raising us girls. Our dad has been an example to us in order to show that struggles can be used as an asset to help struggling people. Our dad has taught us to keep an open mind, to accept others no matter what they're going through. He's taught us to listen to people or we'll never truly understand. Our dad has taught us to do right by others, even when we've been wronged. He's taught us we have to give people a chance. And our dad has taught us, if nothing else, we must lean on God. It's possible to spend the morning talking about all that went wrong, but something is going right. We want to name that before we leave church today. For Mike, standing sober is present and caring, living with integrity and honesty and hopefulness with his family and with Susie today. And this God did. Praise be to God for this large grace. Amen.